Greetings, and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Mention the name Arthur Link to a group of historians, and they will likely cite him as the authority on Woodrow Wilson and all things Progressive Era. But Link was also a husband, father, friend, and colleague who enjoyed playing bridge, tending to his garden, and even cleaning his house. And his wife, Margaret, was an intellectually gifted woman who was the emotional core of her family and a dedicated social activist. Joining me to discuss this unique couple is their youngest of four children, William Link. He is the Richard J. Milbauer Professor of History at the University of Florida and author of seven books, to include Righteous Warrior, Jesse Helms and the Rise of Modern Conservatism, and my personal favorite, The Paradox of Southern Progressivism. Today, Professor Link talks with us about his new book, Links, My Family and American History, published by the University Press of Florida in 2012. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is, to say the least, a unique book for a scholar such as yourself. Then again, you have unique parents. Explain what led you to take on this project.
Well, I think the immediate thing that pushed me into it was the discovery after my parents passed away of this correspondence that they had between the two of them. I think they died, incidentally, my mother died in 1996 and my father in 1998, some time ago now. One goes through a grieving process and sort of an adjustment process when you lose your parents, certainly, and the discovery of these letters was really quite fantastic to me. It was correspondence from the family, but included at its core the correspondence between the two of them, so it was very revealing about how their relationship came into existence and what the nature of the relationship was. So I spent some time going through the correspondence, organizing it. About 10 years after my dad died, decided to write a book about it to try to put it together in a narrative that got to the heart of who these two people were.
So this book is both quite personal, but you're also a professional historian, writing this with a sort of sense of distance and objectivity. Can you talk about how you sort of held those two things in up at once?
Yes, exactly. I think that's an interesting question you've raised, because my impulse as a historian is to write a kind of clinical understanding or analysis. That's how we're trained as professional historians. At the same time, these were my parents, so there's something very personal in there, and there's sort of a balance there, I think, in those two things, and the impulse to be professional and then the very personal experience of doing it, and that was something I became very conscious of as something that was difficult in doing in putting the book together. I think I'd like to think the book's a little unique in the sense that it has kind of the building blocks of good history, that is, in terms of the evidence, the abundant evidence. The correspondence that I mentioned, I ran into in their attic in 1998, and then my dad had extensive correspondence that he kept in Princeton. Very interesting material relating to the historical profession, really, since 1945. So that there was this big mound of kind of traditional manuscript evidence, and then there's this sort of personal element where you try to put the narrative in a personal term and try to understand it in terms of your own relationship to it. That was a bit of a balancing act, I think, and an interesting challenge in writing the book.
Well, another challenge that you took up is revealed, I think, in the subtitle, which is My Family and American History. And this indicates to me that your narrative relates to a larger picture in American history. So what were the themes, events, and ideas of American history that you hoped to emphasize the most?
Well, my parents grew up in a period of very intense change and trial and tribulation, really. My mother was born in 1918 and my father in 1920, so they grew up and came of age during the Great Depression and then experienced World War II and then experienced the Cold War. So in a sense, they're part of the greatest generation, Tom Brokaw called. And I think the really unique part of it, though, the really unique part of the Americanness of the story is their lives as Southerners. They were both native-born Southerners, both of them. My father's born in Virginia, but he grew up in North Carolina, and my mother grew up about 25 miles away in another small town in North Carolina. One of the narratives in the book is really how the two of them, as small town Southerners, came to terms with the world and then went out into the larger world, which is something that's sort of fundamental to what the the South is about in the 20th century, how the South really goes through this very intense change, very suddenly, really, because from the, during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where they move out into the world and suddenly become much more engaged in national development. So the two of them moved away from the South in 1945 and then basically lived outside the South the next 47 years and then returned the last part of their life to the South. So that's, in a way, I think that's one of the I'd like to see as the central theme of their lives and how they experienced it.
And it seemed like Chapel Hill played a large part in this kind of expansion. You call Chapel Hill at the time that they were going there as, quote, an island of free thinking and experimentation. How did this time at this really neat town, at this really neat university, shape the trajectory of their lives?
Well, Chapel Hill and the University of North Carolina in the middle of the 20th century was a place that was adopting very different perspectives on the South. They had become a kind of academic center of what people call the Southern Renaissance. The university was charging ahead and sort of testing traditional taboos on matters of race and matters of labor relations, in fields like sociology and economics, political science, and also history. So for a young man like my father, who grew up in this little town of a few thousand, to come to Chapel Hill in 1937 and stay there for the next 8 years, he received both his BA and his PhD at Chapel Hill, it was a really life-changing experience for him especially. He was exposed to, relatively speaking, for the middle of the 20th century South, the freedom of expression that he'd never experienced before. Come from a fairly closed-minded small town. My mother was an undergraduate at Agnes Scott College in Atlanta, and for her that was an eye-opening experience because she studied under the famous Southern sociologist Arthur Raper, who was a student of lynching and race relations in the South. My mother came to Chapel Hill as a graduate student in 1941. She went there to study with kind of enclave of sociologists that existed in Chapel Hill, people like Howard Odum and Rupert Vance and Guy Johnson. And her interest in Chapel Hill was because it was the major center of the study of social problems in the South. So Chapel Hill was a really unusual moment in the history of North Carolina, history of the South, and it was an unusual moment in the history of the University of North Carolina. And to have my parents placed there really sort of explains the way that they developed as people later on as adults.
And they formed a courtship there. And on this, you write that Arthur, this is your quote, Arthur was in many ways an emotional project who would fulfill Margaret's need to express love through caring. What brought you to this conclusion?
Well, I didn't conclude this through the book, because as observing him as a person, as a child of his, I think it was hard to avoid. He had this kind of combination of intense self-centeredness and genuine love that is a kind of a contradictory element in his life, I think. But what I discovered in the book, I think, is his own background, his own family was basically dysfunctional. The family dynamics of his family when he grew up were such that he insulated himself from the turbulent family that he lived in, and he was protected by his mother. It's a bit of psychoanalyzing, maybe, but I think it's basically true about my dad, Arthur. He had a need, really, to be nurtured that my mother immediately picked up on. And knowing my mother as well, she had a need to nurture people. So in a sense, it was an interesting match because they both sort of fulfilled personal emotional needs that they each had.
I want to turn to your father and to his favorite subject, because this line jumped out at me. Your father once told an interviewer, quote, "I think that aside from St. Paul, Jesus, and the great religious prophets, Woodrow Wilson was the most admirable character I've ever encountered in history." Talk about Arthur's interest and fascination with Wilson and why Wilson ranked so high.
Well, to begin with, you probably should say that's a pretty good example of his tendency toward hyperbole.
Right.
He also just liked to make provocative statements and see if people actually agreed with him. But he genuinely did admire Wilson. I think toward the end of his career, he was accused of being too much of an apologist for Wilson. I don't think that's really true, but it's probably more of a case that the many years that he spent with Wilson, because if you think about it, his entire career was focused on this one man from the 1940s through the 1990s, 50 years. He became increasingly identified with the man. He like Wilson, was a Presbyterian, became a Presbyterian when he met my mother. Like Wilson, had a very strong sense of God acting through history, a kind of Presbyterian Calvinist God, a God that was sovereign and also involved in the workings of humans directly. And then I think he was really, really admired Wilson's mind. So he, when he read what Wilson wrote, when he saw how Wilson thought, he just was very much taken with the way his mind worked. And Wilson had a, whatever you think of Wilson, he had a very unusual mind. So, I would say it's perfectly accurate to say that my dad just liked to talk about Wilson anytime, anywhere. And he often would quote Wilson on a variety of things. I remember one time when I was in graduate school, I brought a dog back. I'd gotten a dog, and we named the dog Maxie, which was a human name. And he quoted Wilson to the effect that humans shouldn't name dogs human names. They should be named dog names. And there was some quote that he pulled out of there that he had. Very often he walked through the door, and he had something exciting he found in the Wilson papers, you know, a new document that showed him something different about Wilson. He had this kind of honest enthusiasm and honest kind of intellectual curiosity about what Wilson was doing, how his mind worked. So, in many ways, a good fit. You know, the two, Arthur Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson, had enough shared kind of past history of Southerners as well that kind of knit the two individuals together. And all those years, he never tired of being with Wilson. I think I can honestly say that.
You mentioned there the Presbyterian connection. And that ends up becoming a real prominent theme in the book, which is your mother and your father's both commitment to their faith. And I'm wondering if you can talk about their respective religious leanings and how it informed who they were and who their family was.
Well, sure. I mean, to start with, both of them, Christianity was at the center of their lives, not just church going, but involvement in matters of faith, talking about faith. Were sort of fundamental things, parts of who they were. That said, I don't think you can describe it as a kind of traditional faith. My father had a kind of intellectualized faith. He grew up in a family where his father was a minister, a Lutheran minister, and his father was very close-minded, acted impulsively, a very smart person, but didn't kind of reconcile his faith through systematic thought. And that's something that my dad just, I think largely because he didn't get along with his father, didn't like. And when he saw evidences of what he saw excessive piety, it really annoyed him. And he associated that with Lutheranism, too. No disrespect meant to Lutherans, but he used to say that there was a Lutheran faith that was long and kind of pious and dour. I think that was kind of his view of Lutheranism. My mother was raised a Presbyterian. She grew up in a college town, Davidson College. Her father was on the faculty there, and it was through and through Southern Presbyterian in the 1920s, and very Sabbatarian, very, very church-oriented, a faith that does emphasize the intellectual construct of the sermon, the literacy, the use of reasoning. And my mother's faith was more sort of action oriented. I don't think as much. My dad was more intellectualized. My mother was more of a, used her faith to guide her social activism. So when she was younger, when she was in college, and then after college, she worked in interracialism, early racial organizations, interracial organizations that existed in the South in the late 30s and 40s. And very much behind that is faith, I think, and how she saw faith as working. So they complemented each other, but they had very different kind of attitudes and approaches toward religion. But for both of them, squarely in the middle of what they were doing, their faith, and they weren't afraid to say it. They weren't embarrassed at all to say what the role of faith was in their lives.
For your father in particular, how do you feel like his colleagues responded to that? And in turn, how did he respond to his colleagues?
Well, as I say, he didn't mind telling anybody what he believed. That's one absolute character of Arthur Link. He spoke his mind, and that would extend to his religion. On the other hand, he didn't try to proselytize, and was very careful about respecting the faith of others, and I think exceptionally tolerant, actually, of world religions. But, you know, for the most part, I think the faculty at Princeton and Northwestern, where he taught, were not churched people. So, in a sense, I think that set him apart, and I think he was regarded as probably a bit of a curiosity because of his Christianity. It also meant that I think his best friends were not in, this is true more of Princeton than Northwestern, his best friends were not in the history department. They were in the church. His very, very close friends who were, that my mother and father knew from Princeton in the Massai Presbyterian Church in right in the middle of Princeton. So in a sense, the center of his life, this is especially true of Princeton in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the center of their life was really the church rather than the department. But it is a bit of a curiosity because faculty tend to be, you know, elite institutions especially, tend not to be particularly church. I think the one exception might have been Jim McPherson, who was James McPherson, the distinguished Civil War historian, who was in their church and actually was a tenor, a soloist in the Nassau Presbyterian Church Choir.
Interesting. I mean, I want to talk about the kind of friendships that he forms, because this is another theme in the book. You talk about his relationship with John Hope Franklin, as well as some of his advisees, from George McGovern to Bill Bradley. I wonder if you could talk about those relationships and what those meant to him.
Well, they all meant a lot to him. He, in the case of John Hope Franklin, first met John Hope in 1943. He was still a graduate student. My father was. And John Hope was a recent PhD, received a PhD from Harvard, then taught in St. Augustine College in Raleigh, an all-black school, and then North Carolina College for Negroes in Durham, which later became North Carolina Central. I know that John Hope Franklin's experience when he came to North Carolina was that he found North Carolina to be a very, very segregated place. John Hope tells a story about going to Raleigh to the state archives, and he couldn't use the reading room because they didn't permit African-Americans in there. And the result was that they put John Hope in a separate area of the archives. He had it all to himself, in a sense. He found that satisfying. But they kept up over many, many years, and a very warm, genuine, extraordinarily genuine individual, and kept up with the entire family and frequently came, stayed with us when I was a child. And they kept up a correspondence, and that's, you know, there's a series of, I don't know, 60 or 70 letters probably over the space of 50 years between the two men that shows a very interesting, genuinely close relationship. George McGovern was his first PhD when he moved to Northwestern. He was at Princeton. My dad was at Princeton for the first 4 years of his career, 1945-49, and then went to Northwestern in 1949. And Princeton didn't let him take any graduate students in the late 40s. In fact, he couldn't even teach his own course until he left. And McGovern was his first PhD. McGovern was a war veteran, World War II veteran, who came on the scene as an adult student. He and my dad were sort of like, I think almost immediately, unusual relationship in that they were sort of contemporaries. And we had always known, you know, about George McGovern. He was a congressman in the 50s and then elected the Senate, I think, in 1962 from South Dakota. They, in his papers, there is a very, very extensive correspondence between the two that indicates an ongoing, very close friendship that survived many, many years. Through the 72 campaign, which McGovern lost disastrously to Richard Nixon. Remember, McGovern came by the house in Princeton a few months after the election in 1973 and was still devastated, clearly, by the election. Bill Bradley was an undergraduate at Princeton who graduated in 1965, and he did a senior thesis under my father. But very close to him, Bradley was a very active Presbyterian those days and went to the church, the Nassau Church. So they saw a good bit of him there. And my dad had kind of a paternal relationship with him, often had him over for Sunday dinner. And then after Bradley became a Rhodes Scholar and was considering options about what to do, should he run for political office or should he go to law school or should he play professional basketball, I came to talk to my I remember them sitting in the kitchen, I guess it was about 1967 perhaps, talking about what he should do. Should he play basketball or go to law school or join the Army, I think were the options at that point. So he's had, you know, those are the John Hope and George McGovern and Bill Bradley sort of examples of the kind of interesting people that crossed his path and crossed the path of both my parents, really. They visit with presidents. My father had lunch with John Kennedy and my mother and father had dinner with Ronald Reagan. So they had a life, you know, for a small town boy, a very interesting life with a lot of kind of.
This really is an interesting life because you document these transitions that they have from North Carolina to Princeton to Northwestern to back to Princeton, and then finally to North Carolina. And I'm wondering, what can you tell me about what life was like for them when they retired and came to North Carolina in those last years?
Well, I think to start with, they were happy to be back in North Carolina, no question about it. It was, in retrospect, I think they always felt very much out of place being in the North. Almost all their friends in Princeton were Southern. It was like expatriates were drawn to each other. They knew how each other spoke. They knew how they thought. They knew how they ate. That kind of thing drew them together. And when they got back to North Carolina, it was like they'd come back home. Plus, they were closer to their family. Being raised in a family that was a couple of Southern expatriates, we spent lots and lots of time in the summer in North Carolina, and we felt as kids that we were really Southern, where we should end up. And myself, my brother, and my sister all ended up in North Carolina at one time. I was in North Carolina for 23 years. So they were nearby. I'd say this, they didn't slow down all that much. I mean, my dad had a lot of interests. When he retired from Princeton, he didn't want to be there, hanging around anymore. And they traveled an extraordinary degree. Father's health got worse and worse, and that became more and more a concern, I think, of the marriage. It kind of took over my mother's life in a way. But they were great lovers of opera. My dad was a sort of an opera fanatic, so they had season tickets to the opera in the first part of the 90s when they were back in North Carolina, and they went back frequently to New York City to see the Metropolitan Opera. So it unfortunately had a short period of time. They moved in 1992, and then my mother got very ill in 1995, so it's really 3 years before things kind of spiraled downwards for them in terms of their health. But they were always North Carolinians, I think always Southerners. That's kind of one of the binding themes of the book, is how they did finally come home, in a sense, once they retired.
Indeed, always Southerners.
Yeah.
This is my last question for you. How did writing this book change your relationship with your parents, or did it?
That's an interesting question. I think it provided me with a kind of closure, and it provided me with a sense of finally sort of resolving what my parents were and understand them to a degree that I hadn't had before. So I had no idea what I was getting into, in a sense, is what I might say, when I started this book, because it got me into an experience of writing history and then thinking about yourself and thinking about what your parents were like that is right at the core of who you are as a person. So that created, in the end, it became a very difficult book to write in that sense, sort of coming to terms with a number of tensions that sort of associated with writing a book like this. But I learned a lot about them both. My father was an avid collector, and especially of letters. He insisted on maintaining his correspondence, and it was a good thing because I'm sure he was the one responsible for keeping the personal correspondence. My mother's tendency would have been to throw it away. I think also she was more private about her correspondence. So I think we're fortunate that my father prevailed in this dialogue, and because it is a truly remarkable correspondence. I was almost tempted to publish an edition of the letters during World War II. They were separated quite a bit during the war, really more separated than together. They write constantly. The year before they're married, 6 months before they're married, they're writing basically every day. So you get this commentary on life in places where they were that is quite interesting. They both were, in very different ways, very, very good letter writers. So I think the correspondence is what brought me closer to them, or at least helped me understand the nature of their relationship and how that relationship came into existence and how it developed and how it matured and what it led to in their lives.
Well, with that, I'd like to conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Links, My Family in American History. Thank you to Bill Link for joining us. You can learn more about Professor Link and his work at his website, williamalink.com. And don't forget to click on over to the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu. There you can listen to this and other podcasts, subscribe to our iTunes feed, and find our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.